Well, it's good to be here. Good to be with you all this evening. Let's get started. Let me pray and we'll get going. Father, thank you so much for your word. Thank you for the time that we can spend tonight. Tonight, Lord, as we look at these different ways that people have thought about you, thought about what's ultimate, and come up with these different, alternate ideas of life, God, I pray that you would use this evening to help us to think and see more clearly who you really are and what you have done for us, how you have designed us. I pray that you would use this evening in a special way in each one of our lives, just the way it needs to be for each of us. In just Jesus' name, amen. Well, we are tab 4, I believe, in your notebook. We're going to be talking about mission or why are we here? We spent the last 2 weeks talking about where did we come from, and now then we're going to spend 2 weeks talking about why are we here. And this particular week, we're going to talk about looking at that, the answer to that question from alternate worldviews, five different alternate worldviews. You will not find any of these worldviews, I don't think, in books or that sort of thing. They're just worldviews that I've put together trying to analyze the philosophers and the theologians at times that I have read and everything, and trying to make sense of it myself. So that's what we're looking at, these five what I call alternate worldviews to the one that we're going to look at next week, which is a biblical worldview. How does the Bible answer the question, why are we here? So when we talk about why are we here tonight and next week, we're really looking at purpose. What's the purpose of being here? No matter where we came from, there's a reason that we're here. And what is that purpose? What is that mission that we are here to accomplish in some form or fashion? And we want to look at that in more detail, how the world has been answering that since the days of Plato. The person we want to focus on there in your notes tonight, on page one of your notes, is a geologist who changed modern thinking, Charles Darwin. It's interesting. I don't know that that you can go a whole year without one of the few major networks or publishing companies of magazines writing something about Darwin. It's just amazing to me how he continues to come up. Even though Darwin lived in the 19th century, in the 1800s, he born and died during that time, pretty much that whole decade. He was born in 1809, died in 1882. That was when he lived. That was a long time ago. He was born over 200 years ago, and we're still writing about him and having shows about him on a regular basis, it seems like, relatively speaking. He's had a lot more airtime than I have, I know that, so that just seems like a lot to me. But anyway, yeah, it doesn't take much. The interesting thing about Darwin is his background. Darwin was born and raised in England, and he came from a fairly well-to-do background. One of his grandfathers was a very prominent physician and a well-known poet in England in the 1800s, early 1800s. And one of his other grandfathers was an industrialist, and he was very wealthy. Both of them were wealthy. Both of his parents came from fairly wealthy backgrounds. And that's where he grew up. When he got to time to go to college, first of all, he went to Edinburgh and to study medicine, because one of his grandfathers was a doctor. He thought he had been encouraged to go in that direction. So he went to study medicine, and he was there for 2 years, and he ran into a couple of problems. One of the problems was that he really didn't like chemistry, he found out. And if you're going to study medicine, you got to enjoy chemistry, because you're going to study an awful lot of it, and a lot's going to be expected of you there. The second thing that he had a problem with, he realized, was that the sight of blood made him very squeamish, and he had a hard time with that. And he began to realize, you know what, I don't know that this is really what I'm cut out to do. And so he left Edinburgh and went to Cambridge. And at Cambridge, he enrolled to study for the ministry. And he went to Cambridge for 4 years and got a degree for to be a minister, to be a pastor of a church. Interesting. Some of you are saying, I never knew that. I never thought about that before. But that's what he studied for. When he graduated, one of his professors at Cambridge had arranged the possibility for him to go on a 5-year around-the-world trip on a ship, the HMS Beagle. And he was a little uncertain. He had been preparing for the last 4 years to go into ministry, and now to leave and go away on this long voyage for 5 years. It wasn't some kind of a great cruise ship or anything that we're talking about here. This was going to be roughing it kind of sailing for 5 years. They were going to be gone. But his father thought it was a great idea and that he ought to go on this. And his father's the one who really moved him in that direction. His father had never been too excited about him being in ministry to begin with. Not that he wasn't a God-fearing man. He claimed to believe in God, but he just really didn't want his son to go into that. And so he really pulled a lot of strings and convinced Darwin that he needed to go on this trip, and he did. So he goes on this trip for 5 years. While he's on this trip, there are records from his journals about how he was made fun of by the sailors on the ship on a regular basis for how much time he spent reading his Bible and praying. And they ridiculed him, made fun of him for doing that. But as you read his journals going through that during that 5-year period, you see that kind of activity diminishing more and more, and it being replaced by a greater and greater enthusiasm for his hobby, which was geology and natural science. Even though he had majored in medicine and majored in ministry, what he found was he really loved his hobby, which was geology and natural science. And so he had the opportunity over that 5-year period to see a lot of things that most people in the world had never seen before. And he saw things all over the world. Most of their trip was around South America, and they spent a lot of time there. And he began to classify things, name things. He began to see trends and things, and he began to write, and he kept detailed logs. As an amateur geologist, a natural scientist, he would keep detailed logs of what he saw and what he was discovering. And he was really excited about that. It wasn't until 20 years after they returned. Okay, so 25 years after he graduated from Cambridge for ministry, 5 years on the HMS Beagle, 20 years later, he wrote his first book dealing with the origin of the species based upon natural selection. And it was like a bombshell, not in a bad way for a lot of people in the world, but in an exciting way. It was like something happened all of a sudden, something clicked. You see, evolution was something that had been around ideologically. People had thought about it for over 100 years. We can go back to universities in England particularly and see professors and others who were talking about the idea, the theory, potentially, of evolution, because we sure look an awful lot like apes, and we have a lot of things in common with them, and all the way back, we can, a lot of similarities there. And so they were postulating the possibility of this, but what they found in The Origin of the Species based upon natural selection, his book, was that now then we've got evidence. Now, Darwin never claimed that what he, that everything he was postulating was fact. In fact, if you look at his own writings, he makes the declaration, a lot of this is speculative on my part. I want to read that to you in just a second. But he speculated a lot. He drew what he speculated would be some of the transformations that could have taken place from this kind of animal to this kind of animal. And he speculated about that in some of his drawings. The interesting thing is, some of those drawings are still showing up in college textbooks, even though from the very beginning, by his very admission, they were speculation of what might have been. But they are not presented as speculation in most colleges. How many of you, beginning back junior high, high school, had to learn about evolution? Yeah, just about everybody in here. I remember in fifth, sixth grade was my introduction to evolution, and I cannot remember hardly a class that I had in junior high school, or college that I didn't have evolution taught. I mean, it didn't matter what the subject was, it always started with evolution, because we all, here's our roots, here's where we evolved from, and that sort of thing. I want to read to you from in his last book, major book that he wrote, The Descent of Man. In his general summary and conclusion, which is several pages long, I just want to read a few things here from it to you. He says, a brief survey, summary, will be sufficient to recall the reader's mind of more salient points in this work. Many of the views which had been advanced are highly speculative, and some, no doubt, will prove erroneous. He's saying from the very beginning, I'm speculating, and I know that some of my speculation will be proven to be wrong down the line. But I have in every case given the reasons which have led me to one view rather than to another. He goes on and he says, false facts are highly injurious to the progress of science, for they often endure long. Interesting. False facts are highly injurious to the progress of science, for they often endure long. He says, don't make theories facts until there's enough evidence to do that. And don't make facts out of speculation, because what happens, he goes on and explains in some of his other writings, when we stop when we start making theories into facts without enough evidence, what we're doing is we move from being scientists, which he was committed to being, to becoming propagandists. We've got something to sell and to prove to other people, to sell to them. And we stop being scientists. And he's calling here and in some of his other writings as well, for those who come after him, some of this is speculation. It's not fact. Don't make it fact until there's enough evidence to do that. So he is calling even upon those in the future to be careful about what was coming. Some of the things that I appreciate about Darwin is that he does seem to be intellectually honest in his writings. I think he would be sad at some of the things that are being taught today in his name, because they have been information that he speculated about that has never been proven, but it's being taught as fact. So I think he would be sad. I think he had an intellectual honesty about him. He said, this is speculation, this is the evidence that I've gathered, and here's why I've come to this conclusion over this one. A lot of integrity in all of that. But what has been made of it is something different. The sad thing for me about Darwin is how he moved, as you read his journals, how he moved away from God. Because he realizes also in his writings, especially The Descent of Man, we've stepped off of this high pedestal of being created in the image of God. But if he is right about how we got here, where we came from, then we have stepped off this pedestal of being created in the image of God, and all we are is advanced primordial ooze that has developed That's all that we are. And it's all by chance for us. And that's very sad to me, to see his picture of God be shaped more by his theories than by the scriptures that he had studied when he was at Cambridge. Okay, now, enough about Darwin. We'll talk more about him off and on throughout the semester. On page 2 of your notes, we want to look at the first of these alternate worldviews. You might want to have that colored chart as well. Looks like this. You might want to have that out because we are going to take that column that says mission, and we're going to follow that all the way across. And the first one there is the first area we come to is a personal theistic substitute and then an impersonal theistic substitute. Remember, the first two of these five alternate worldviews are theistic. They believe in some form of a God. They would say, do you believe in God? And they would say, yes. And they believe that that God, they would say, yes, I believe in God. One of those views says it's a personal God. The other one says it's an impersonal God, an it kind of thing. The last two views are atheistic views predominantly. They would say there is no God, and then one of them would substitute something that was personal, and one would substitute something that was impersonal for God. Even though they wouldn't call it God, they say it's ultimate, and they make it God. It's a good modern description of what an idol is, taking something else and making it God in some form or fashion. And then there's the middle view, the dualistic view that we'll talk about as well. Okay, let's look at this first one, a personal theistic substitute for God. Remember, this would be deism, finite godism, open theism would be a modern view that would fall into this category in many ways as well. A personal theistic substitute. Do you believe in God? Yes. Do you believe in the God of the Bible? Most of them would say yes. Do you believe that God created the world? Most of them would say yes. Where did you come from? Most of them would say from God. The Creator, and they would refer to him as God in some form or fashion. However, in one way or another, they will say that this God is responsible for everything that's here and will ultimately hold us accountable in a future judgment. But while we are here on earth, we are responsible for making things work. He has chosen deliberately, he's either chosen deliberately to withdraw himself from this earth in terms of any involvement, or some of these views would say he's inept, he's not capable of getting engaged thoroughly in the affairs of this world. So one way or another, they remove him for all practical purposes from his involvement in the world, even though they believe he's there, and that they will one day stand before him. Most of these people would believe that as well. So these are the folks who believe in that God is the giant clockmaker that wound the universe up in his creation and set it on a shelf, and now he's made it so that it'll run on its own. Now then, having said that, look at the four points at the top. These are some of my attempts at summarizing some of this. And then I've got some quotes from people on the bottom. And we're not going to read all of those quotes. I know that you enjoyed the reading so much this week from Jean-Paul Sartre, so I'm not going to make you read all of these things below. I'll talk more about that in a little bit. But anyway, number one, there is a personal creator God who created systems to make life work for mankind. Think about a clock. It's got all kinds of wheels and pendants and all kinds of things in there that all are necessary and all function together. Everything is dependent on, but it's made to function a certain way. Think about the world that we live in. And what this view believes is God, like that clock, wound the earth up, made it very intricate so that everything works And he set it in motion. And now then our responsibility is to make sure we understand how it works. Find what they would often call the systems, the things that make life work. How does this relate to this, and how do they work together? How does this relate to this, and how do they work together? How does that and that work together? Everything from marriage relationships to morality to societies to governments, everything. How does all that function and work together? So there's a personal created God who created systems to make life work for mankind. Let me give you some buzzwords here under number one that you're going to see over and over again. You might want to write these down. When you read deistic writings, these are some of the things you're going to see. First of all, systems. You're going to see that a lot, the word systems. You're going to see laws of nature. You're going to see laws of nature being referred to. Laws of nature. In other words, they're saying there's natural law. There's just natural things that are true in nature that we can observe. You're going to see emphasis upon contracts. That's a buzzword that you'll see a lot in deistic writing. Some will refer to it as contract theory, but it's another word that'll show up, another way of talking about system. So if this and this are meant to work together in a certain way, it's as if there's a contractual agreement that if this is supposed to do this and this is supposed to do this, then this has a responsibility to do its part and this has a responsibility to do its part. Whether that's a government and the people, whether that's friendships, whether it's morality in a society, and how my contract with society is such that I need to carry out my responsibilities and society needs to carry out its responsibilities as I relate with society, etc. You'll see some other buzzwords like common sense. Thomas Paine wrote a book called that, but he popularized it, but that was something you would see a lot, common sense. Or another phrase very similar to that, a buzzword, phrase is self-evident. If something is self-evident, it's obvious. Anybody could see that if they just look at it. It's self-evident. It makes itself very clear. You don't have to look very hard. You'll see some other things like reasonable and logical a lot, although you'll see those in other things. You'll see social contract is another emphasized buzz phrase, social contract. Between God and mankind, between mankind and the government, between the individual and society, these social contracts that are there. So those are some of the buzzwords. So when we read a little bit down below, you're going to see some of those buzzwords. I just want you to see them because they're going to show up in there. Number two, we're asking the question now, why are we here? Purpose, mission. What is our mission for being here? Listen to number two. Mankind was created to rule over this planet and make the systems work. That's our mission. That's why we are here, is to rule over this planet, to figure out and make the systems work. To observe this planet, see how things work, and make sure that they work that way. We are responsible for that. And you will see emphasis upon responsibility. You will see emphasis upon duty. It is my duty as a part of mankind to not only observe what's going on in the world, but to carry out my portion of that contract or system or whatever it may be. I have a duty to do that. You will see emphasis upon we have to do this, or we've been given this responsibility by God. And they'll say that in different ways, but you're going to see that in some of the literature down below. Number three, God will hold each person responsible to please him by working within the rules of his systems, and making the world a better place. So part of what we're going to be judged on is, did you figure out what the systems were, and then did you faithfully work the systems that I put in place to help you live life? Did you do that or not? Did you figure them out? And did you do? And God's going to hold us accountable one day for how well we did that. Therefore, heaven is something that is believed in but earned. It is something we have to earn our way to get there, and everything. But there's also a slight emphasis. There was a growing emphasis within deism in its heyday. Not that it's not around anymore, but when it was really, really popular during the period of our revolution in America and after, what you saw was the more we figure the systems out and follow the systems, we're making this world a better and better place. And there was sort of a utopian idea, if we keep doing this well, we will make this world heaven on earth. We can do that if we'll just figure these systems out and make them work. Okay, number four. These systems include, and these are just some of the things, personal morality. In other words, part of the way God designed life to work was you don't cheat, you don't steal, you don't lie, you don't murder, you don't do some of those kinds of things. Morality, personal morality. Another one was marriage and family order and responsibility. Most of them had very, especially during the 1700s, 1800s, had very clear responsibilities for what the role of a husband was, what the role of a wife was, what the responsibilities of a child were, rules of responsibility when it came to friendships and that sort of thing. Number three, social respect and order. Sort of the golden rule kind of effect that you ought to, there's certain etiquette, there's certain protocol, there's a certain amount of decorum that you're supposed to follow. Think about the 1700s and 1800s and how much emphasis was on socially. You're supposed to dress a certain way, act a certain way. If you're in this station in life and you meet with somebody of a higher station in life, there was etiquette about how you're supposed to treat them and relate to them. And all of that was very important because that was part of the system. That was part of the way God designed life, they said. And that needed to be followed. And number four, a social contract with the government instituted by God for the provision and protection of the people. In other words, they believed during the 1700s and 1800s that God, one of the things that God set up was this contract between government and the people under that government. Whether it was a monarchy, which it mostly was, going into the 1700s, it's pretty much all it was a monarchy, a king or a queen over all the people. And whatever it was, the government and the people had a contract, God had a system set up. And when the government didn't fulfill its responsibilities to provide and protect the people had a duty to overthrow that government and replace it with a government who would do something that would provide and protect for them. Okay? Now, all this goes back to this belief that God is not involved in the world. Where does this come into play? Virtually nowhere. The only place you will see this referred to, this book, the Bible, referred to in deistic literature, for the most part, has to do with, you know, it's got a lot of good stories in it that give us ideas about morality. You don't lie, you don't cheat, you don't steal, you don't murder, you don't do those kind of things. That's helpful to give us some ideas and everything. But was this something that was inspired by God and given to man? No. Why? Why did no deist believe that? Because inspiration is supernatural. It's God involved in this world, and they didn't believe he was involved. So this book had no place. How many have ever heard of Jonathan Edwards? Some of you have. He was a great preacher back in the day, and he has been resurrected in some of his writings in recent days. A great theologian, great thinker, took over the pastorship of a large church in Northampton in Massachusetts, in that area, New England, out of seminary, a brilliant man, a fiery preacher, and everything. But he got kicked out of, some of you have heard of Jonathan Edwards, he got fired from that big church. You know why? Because most of the people there were deists. And he was against that, and he was preaching against that, speaking about a sovereign God who is involved. You read his writings, and you see he's speaking out to people who are part of his church, the largest church in that area, writing to them. He's speaking to them about there is an almighty God, and he is involved. And they fired him, got rid of him. So that's sort of what's going on. So what's to summarize all this from a mission point of view, why are we here? It's mainly to discover and to get in line with and to follow through on the systems that God has put in place for us. Discover them, put them into practice, be faithful about that, because God's going to judge you someday. So that's our mission, to do that. And in doing so, the byproduct of that is this will become a better and better world. Okay? Now then, look at a couple things down below. We're not going to look at all of these. Look at the last three lines in that first paragraph there. John Locke wrote, "Everyone, as he is bound to preserve himself and not to quit his station willfully, so by that the like reason, when his own preservation comes not in competition, ought as much as he can to preserve the rest of mankind." What is he doing there? He's giving us rules for living, a system by which you take care of yourself, but where you need to, you do everything you need to make sure you take care of everybody else as well, that everyone else is taken care of. So he is writing about that. Look down at the next one. Government, which is one of those parts of a system, was intended by that omniscient being who can never be deceived by any event or operation. But since he gave rise to it, not by any particular or miraculous interposition, but by his concealed and universal efficacy, whatever actually happens is comprehended in the general plan or intention of providence. He's talking about God had these intentions. God had a design. We need to figure out what that is. But he's not involved. No more miraculous stuff here. He's not involved in that. We've got to figure it out. David Hume. Thomas Jefferson, the last one. This is taken from the Declaration of Independence. Notice some of the buzzwords here as well. But when a long train of abuses and usurpations pursuing invariably the same object evinces a design to reduce them under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, speaking of the people under a government, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. Such has been the patient sufferance of these colonies, and such is now the necessity, not just the desire, but the necessity, which constrains them to alter their former systems of government. There's that systems again. How we do things needs to be altered. Again, God is either uninvolved or he is inept. Deism would say he's uninvolved. Finite godism and open theism would say he's inept. The world's got out of hand, and he really can't keep up with everything. So he may be involved, but it's very limited, and you really can't count on him to help you. Okay, let's go to the next one. That was a personal theistic substitute for God. This is an impersonal theistic. Do you believe in God? Yes. And in one form or another, they would say, "and it," when they refer to God. Now, I say that, and I keep saying that. I've said it every week, I think. But When you read their literature, there are times when they alternate. Sometimes they refer to God as it, or a thing of some sort, or the universe, or sometimes they'll refer to him with a pronoun he or him as well. But when you read the whole of what they're writing, you keep realizing they're not talking about him in the same way we talk about it from this book. They're talking about something different altogether. So, number one, these 4 points up above. God is the essence of the power and material of the universe, which has eternally existed. So this universe has eternally existed. God has eternally existed. This universe, the sum of its parts, when all put together, makes up a greater being, thing, called God, that is determinative, that determines things. And they would refer to that. It's eternal. Now think about this. Some of the Eastern religions that believe in reincarnation, they were almost forced into that belief. If this universe is God and it's always existed, that means everything that's here has always been here and will always be here in some form. And so they've got to explain there is no heaven or hell in their belief system. So there's got to be some way of describing, well, what happens to us when we go back into the earth and our body becomes a part of the earth. Well, we're still a part of God. We're still a part of the universe. We are eternal. We don't just go away. We come back in a different form. And then they would add in how we can advance, how we come back and all of that. But it was sort of we've got to do something with us because we don't go away, because we're eternal, because we're part of the universe, which is God. Number two, this material force called God does not have a free will like mankind, nor a grand purpose like the God of the Bible. It exists, it's non-purposeful, it's non-personal, it doesn't choose, it just is. Now, I say that, and yet they would say it doesn't have, generally speaking, they would say the universe doesn't, this God that is the universe collectively, some would say it has a mind or it has a will about it. Some would say it doesn't at all. Everything is by chance. If you move more toward the modern day naturalist who would buy into this view quite often, they're going to say, no, it doesn't really have a mind. But if you go back to some of the older areas of the world, they're going to say, no, it doesn't have a mind of its own at all. It doesn't do anything. It's just there. Number three, neither does the material force have a goal for mankind. There is no ultimate purpose for mankind's existence other than to perpetuate and improve the world. So think about it. It's sort of a secondhand mission or purpose that we inherit. If we're a part of this world, which is God, this universe, which is God, and it's always been and always will be, we might as well, if we're going to always be here, we might as well make it a better place. So that becomes a sort of a secondhand mission for us, is to make it a better place to be. Leave it better than how we found it. So in this view, let's move on. We'll get into some of that I'm thinking of in the couple of views from now that are very related to this. This impersonal theistic substitute for God and is very similar, I've mentioned this before, to the impersonal atheistic view for God. And we'll look at that when we get there. Number four, mankind is here by a blind act of the material force. Therefore, mankind should take care of the material force of which he is a part. What does this lead to? While I am alive as a human being from this vantage point, I need to take care of myself. I need to do everything I can to guarantee that I can come back in a better form than I was before. Do I have any ultimate responsibility to you or anyone else in this world? No. No, you need to take care of yourself. I'll take care of myself. Now, it would be beneficial if we could work together to make this a better world in some form or fashion, for all of us to live in eternally in some form or fashion. That would be ideal. But in terms of responsibility, it's all about me. And it promotes a self-centered utilitarianism. What works? What works? Does the universe have morality? Does it have a code of conduct passed on to us? No. So I do whatever it takes to get whatever I want. I remember reading one of the Bodhisattvas of Buddhism, one of their holy books. I'll never forget this story, and it's a one of their high spiritual leaders who is speaking in this Bodhisattva, this story, and he is trying to train this young man how he can come back in a better form. And so what he trains him to do, and it's really interesting to read, but what he trains him to do, he says, I want you to go to a street corner where there are a lot of people and make sure there are women there. And what I want you to do is I want you to make eyes at them. I want you to make suggestive motions to them. I want you to do all kinds of things suggestively to get their attention and everything and to get them to judge you. Because as they judge you, they lose some of their good stuff and you get it. So he was teaching him to trick other people to get so that he would get some of their good stuff and give it to him and everything. And I'm thinking, man. And there was just story after story like that, which was really interesting when they don't believe in good and bad, that they could have good stuff and bad stuff. But anyway, that was the kind of thing that this leads to, is this self-centered, selfish, utilitarian, whatever works. There is no morality. It's just whatever works. Why are you here? Take care of yourself. Come back in a better form. That's ultimately it. And if there's some way we can make this a better world together, then that's a plus. That's a benefit. But I just want to make sure at least I come back in a better form. Okay. I'm not even going to read what's down below. More Spinoza, you can read that. Let's look at the next view. A compromised dualistic substitute for God. This goes back to Plato, dualism does. Some of you have been reading Nancy Piercy's book, and you've read a lot about Plato and some of the impact that he had. And you'll notice she refers to the upper story and the lower story in her book a lot. And what she's talking about is going back to Plato, and she makes reference to that, that he introduced this idea that there was not one eternal reality called God. There were two eternal realities, one which was the material world, which is evil, and the other was the world of the mind or thinking or reason or logic, and that was eternal and it was good. So I put this in the middle of all these because he's saying there is a material world that is eternal, and it's eternally evil. But he's also saying at the same time there's an equal force that is good, that is mind, reason, logic, thinking. It's always been and always will be. So what he did was introduce not one God, but two eternal realities that cannot be destroyed, neither one of them. So they are both, in a sense, ultimate. And he will talk in his writings about the way that these work in terms of practicality is we can never get rid of evil because we have a material world. We'd have to get rid of ourselves because we have a material body. We'll never get rid of evil totally, but we need to learn to think and reason and use logic and that sort of thing, education of our minds to where we can put evil in its place and not let it get out of control. That's what we need to do. So, let's look at points 1, 2, and 3. Mankind is made up of an eternal material body, which is evil, and an eternal immaterial soul, his mind, reason, thought, logic, which is good, according to Plato. Again, Nancy Piercy talked about the upper story and lower story, these two things. But the thing that she's getting at that I think is very insightful is that it's not so much that today we believe that that everything material is evil and everything thinking, reason, logic, knowledge is good and they're both eternal. We don't necessarily think that way, but what Plato did was introduce this bifurcation, this taking God and making two gods, two realms of eternity, two realms of reality that don't touch each other, but can coexist. And so we have our personal life, and we have our public life in the world we live in today. Our personal life, our public life. And they don't have to necessarily match up. Why is it that we live in a culture today that going back a number of years ago had to ask the question and continues to ask it in some ways, does what a person does in private affect their public life? What are they doing? They've believed there's two worlds, and they don't necessarily have anything to do with each other, and I can live equally in both of those. Or I can have my Christian life, and I can have my worldly life. I can have my Friday night life, and I can have my Sunday morning life. And though they seem to be opposites, I can live in both of those worlds quite comfortably, we think. We think we can do both of those. And that the one doesn't impact the other. And that's where Plato has had such an influence in the world we live in today, because we think we live in these two realities, and one doesn't necessarily have an impact on the other one at all. Number two, therefore, a person should feed, accentuate, develop, and use their soul side, which is the mind, to defeat their material body side, to bring it under control, submission. Plato used an illustration in one of his stories about a yard, and there were two dogs. One was large and one was small. The large one had been there for a while, and the owner put in this fenced-in yard somehow, fenced-in cage, whatever it was, this smaller dog. And the smaller dog was determined that he or she was not going to let the big dog bully her or him. And so she became ferocious, and she just attacked that big dog. She would get beat up, she'd get messed up, but she just kept relentlessly attacking the big dog until the big dog finally, even though the little dog was no match for it, got so tired of being nibbled at and barked at and bit at by the little dog just relentlessly, that eventually the big dog went over in the corner, laid down, and just cowered away and let the little dog have the whole use of the yard. And he's saying that's the way it is with good and evil, with our mind and the material world. The material world is evil, and it's a lot of it. It's very influential. But our mind needs to be like that little dog that just is relentlessly pursuing and attacking this evil material world with knowledge, reason, logic, so that we put it in its place and it's not as effective on us anymore. Does that make sense? That's what he was teaching. That's what we need to do. Mankind's highest goal, number three, is to make the world a better place over time by the use and development of their soul, which is mind, reason, thought, and logic. He referred to it as soul, but he also defined it for us, so I'm trying to do that for you as well. So, he talks about that. The highest goal is to make the world a better place over time by using our mind, reason, and logic. That's what we need to do. Now, Plato, by the way, was a polytheist. He believed in many gods, but you need to realize when we talk about polytheism in those days, in the 400 BCs, none of those gods, none of the Greek or Roman gods were eternal. None of them were God like we think about God. They were more like we would have our superheroes today kind of characters, or our people that we look at in cartoons and stuff who can do superhuman things, but they have a beginning and they have an end, and there's a limit to their power, and that's the way their gods were that he believed in. Polytheism was that kind of belief system, but he only believed in two things that were eternal: evil, material world, and the world of thinking, reason, logic, and thought. Look at the last quote down at the bottom. All of these are by Plato, all three of these. The last two are taken from his book called The Laws, or just Laws. Most of the time that Plato wrote in his life, he was writing stories. They're called dialogical stories. They were dialogues between a teacher and a student or students who would be walking along, and the teacher would be asking questions and doing things to bring out things from the students and lead them down a path of thinking, reason, logic. Often the person he was talking about was named Socrates, who had been his teacher. And he wrote about Socrates. You don't hardly ever see any of Plato's early writings written about himself or him saying, here's what I believe. He would just write these stories about a teacher and these students or these people who would be learning things as they dialogued with him. And it was very safe for Plato to do that. Part of the reason, I may have mentioned this before, but part of the reason he did that is because Socrates, though he wasn't a voluminous writer, he taught a lot, said a lot of things publicly about what he believed, and he got the benefit that came to that was the people overseeing his city gave him the opportunity to either drink the hemlock or face the gallows. He could either commit suicide or they were going to help him out with that because he spoke out about the government and about people and officials. So Plato was too shrewd. So he just told all of Socrates' stories. This was Socrates, that's what Socrates believed. I'm just telling his stories, writing them down, passing them around, and that sort of thing. But near the end of his life, when he had little to lose, he started writing more directly, here's what I believe. And in Laws, he's doing that. He's writing more directly, here's what I believe. You can kill me. You can take my life because I don't have much of it left anyway. It's near the very end of his life. Notice this is volume 12 of Laws. It was huge what he wrote. Let's look at that last one. The dream on which we touched a while ago in our talk. That would be, if you read the context of the story, that's the dream there is the goal. This is what I would anticipate. This would be the ideal that could happen, the mission, if you will. The dream on which we touched a while ago in our talk, when we painted our picture of the partnership of the mind and the head. will have found its fulfillment in real and working fact if and when, and you might want to underline this, we have seen our men scrupulously selected, duly educated, settled at the end of the process in the nation's central fortress, and established there as guardians whose likes we have never seen in our whole lives for a perfection as protectors. Now, part of this is the goal, but part of it is the how we're going to get there. Sorry, ladies, he was very specific here and other places that it was going to take men to do this. He didn't have a whole lot of good things to say about ladies' minds, unfortunately, back in that day. But he's saying it's going to take these men who are scrupulously selected, duly educated, guardians like we've never seen. So every city would have these young men who had bright minds, who would be get the best education they could, and they would be put in these fortresses in the city, and basically barracks, and they would live there. They wouldn't have freedom to go, and no one would have freedom to get to them. They would be protected, and they would make decisions about what was best for our city. And he's speaking about how can we make this world a better place? That's how we can do it. And he's speaking about very utopian ideas. How can we finally get this evil material world in the corner of the yard bowing before our minds? Okay? This is how we can do it. That's how we can do it. But that's the idea. We can get evil in its proper place, then we'll have a more idyllic world. I wouldn't call it utopia completely in terms of being a perfect world, but he says it would be a much better world. It would be a dream, an ideal world that we would live in if we could do that. Does that make sense? That's the mission for this group of people. Why are we here? We're here for the purpose of making this world as good as we can in spite of the evil that is here. Now, the next subject we're going to talk about after mission is we're going to talk about evil. Where did it come from and why is it here? Can anything be done about it? We're going to look at all of that in the next few weeks. But that's what he's saying, putting the evil world in its place and making this a better world by doing that. Okay. Let's look at alternate worldview number 4. Remember, I said that an impersonal atheistic substitute for God is not that dissimilar from a theistic, an impersonal theistic substitute for God. And why is that? Because the theistic substitute for God is really a thing. It's really not God, the God of the universe that we know about and that sort of thing. And it's not that much different than having no God at all from a that point of view. And so what you see is this impersonal atheistic view of God. They have come up with substitutes for God. There is not any famous writer who hasn't come up with something that is an ultimate. And that it becomes their God. And so we see that written about more here than we do back there. But there's a lot of overlap. Now, I say atheistic, some of them, to be honest, some of who would hold to this, are more agnostic. They would not be so bold as to say there is no God, but what they would say is, if there is a God, we can't know about it, and it doesn't make any difference anyway because there's no evidence of him, his involvement at all. So it doesn't make any difference. So, number one, there is no creator God to look to or count on, or if there is, we can't know about him, and therefore it doesn't make any difference. This is the universal starting point for both of these last two views we're going to look at. Defensively saying the view of this book about God is wrong. That's where they start. That is not the way it is. Number two, There are impersonal forces at work in the world that are determinative, that determine things. Now, let me give you some examples. You might want to write these down. They probably would never call these things God, but the way they talk about them, the way they look at them, they treat them as if they are God, as if they determine what's going to go on. So they're ultimate in some form or fashion. So Spinoza and many others would say that nature is ultimate. Now, it would be a very similar thing to go back to saying this universe. Spinoza would say this universe is God, collectively. This is God. Therefore, we need to worship God. Can you see it's a very small step from there to saying, therefore, we need to worship nature. We need to worship the things in this world around us because they're equally God. There is no difference to Spinoza and to a naturist, a person who would hold nature up, even though they would be atheistic. There is no practical difference between them when it comes to this because they would say everything in nature is equally valuable. That tree is just as valuable as you are. You are no more important. You are just another animal. You're just more advanced than a lot of them, but you're just another animal. And that's a tree, and we're all part of nature, and they would talk about that. Now, I think here on the West Coast and in the Northeast, there's a little bit more of this going on. Typically speaking, I know when I lived in the Northwest, it was a shocking experience to hear some of these things spoken of as if, well, everybody knows that. And so, anyway, nature is one of those things that is an impersonal force that is determinative. Human history is another one. Who believed in that? Karl Marx, yes, he taught that. Along with Friedrich Engels, the two of them wrote a lot of things together and everything about all of this, but human history becomes determinative. Human history is like a giant wheel going through time, and it's just going to keep on going, and your job is to figure out where it's at and get on the good side of it, or it's going to roll over you. Another one that has been postulated in recent years has been the environment. Now, Rick, isn't that nature? No, we're talking about your environment, where you were born, where you grew up, the environment around you. B.F. Skinner would say that is what determines who you are. If you want to change a person, change their environment, and it will change the person. Because the environment in which a person grows up is determinative on how they're going to grow up. He had a little bit difficult time with twins who were born in the same home, in the same environment, but went in very different directions in life. But he was an intellectual, and he could always talk himself out of that, it seemed like, even if it made no sense at all. Sort of like what you read this week. Jean-Paul Sartre was trying to explain how being an existentialism is humanism. It's a form of humanism. When he wrote about existentialism, he was criticized by a lot of humanists, his colleagues, who didn't believe in God either, etc. But they felt like he was getting away from human, so they wrote and criticized him a lot for believing in existentialism and everything. And so he is writing a paper that makes absolutely no sense at all by a very intellectual person. And you see a lot of circle reasoning. You see a lot of illogic being presented as if it were logical. You see a lot of that intellectualism that's just going around in circles but not going anywhere. Now, some of you are saying, Rick, why in the world, if you knew that, did you have us read that? I wanted you to see the extent to which very smart people will go to defend what they believe to be true, even though it makes no sense whatsoever. Okay? So, anyway, I promise I don't think there's any more like that. But anyway, you may think that there are in our readings, but I don't think so. Another one, an impersonal force at work in the world, number two there, that are determinative. Plato would say the mind, the mind. And though, even though we put Plato in the dualistic side a while ago, his influence, there would be people today even who would say the mind is the most important thing. I don't know about you, but I grew up in an era, I was telling a couple here before we got started, I was in junior high school before I found out you didn't have to go to college. Literally, I'm not kidding. My parents brought me up with the belief, and I loved them, but they brought me up with believing that the key to making me a better man ultimately was to get as much education as I could. Because this was the key. And they literally, I never knew. They always talked about college. You go to the 7th through 12th grade, and then you got 4 more years after that, and then maybe more after that. I just thought that's what everyone had to do. Because my parents believed this was the Savior. This was the most important thing in life to help us have a better life and a better world and everything. Am I against education? No, I'm not against education. Am I against my parents? No, not against my parents. But there is that belief. I remember raising our children, and I would be around families that where their son or daughter went to college and what college they got into was going to determine the whole course of that person's life, for good or bad. If they didn't get into that school, life was going to be ruined the rest of their life. And it's like, really? Really? Anyway, the mind, it's something that Plato introduced in a different way, but mankind has picked up on it. Think about in America today. Thomas Jefferson did a lot of good things, and I'm not against this one thing that he did, but he bought into this, the mind thing. As a deist, he bought into this, and he said, that is what is ultimate. That is why every child has to go to school, and the person who introduced required public education for all students and all children in America was Thomas Jefferson for this reason. For this reason, because this is what's ultimate in many ways in the world in which we live. I'm not against public education. I'm just saying that's how things get started sometimes. Number three, mankind should recognize that force, or those forces, recognize that force that we've been talking about above, or those forces, and get in step with them. That's something that we need to do. And everything. And number four, in so doing, mankind will fulfill his purpose. So here we're looking at mission. In so doing, mankind will fulfill his purpose of making a better life for himself and making this a better world. Now, there's an inconsistency there, but we're going to look at that in a minute. But that's what you will often hear from people with this worldview. I need to make this a better world, better life for me, and make this a better world to live in. That's what I need to do. Now, we don't want to look at all of these down below, but we have down below things here by Spinoza. Again, I've told you, he very similar to some of these things here. Karl Marx, who talks about human history in a ultimate way as well. Look at the last one, though. This is written by Engels and Marx, Karl Marx, one of their many publications. They wrote a communist manifesto, but they wrote prefaces to that to every major country or city that they would be involved in to gear it toward them and their situation. And this one is for England, the English preface of the 1988 Manifesto to the Communist Party by Engels and Marx. First published in 1848, and then in 1888. So this book was published, its second version, 6 years after Charles Darwin died. And 20-some years after his first book came out, On the Origin of Species. He says, this proposition of human history being determinative, this principle that we're talking about, this proposition, is destined to do for history what Darwin's theory has done for biology. So by this point, he is already comparing what the impact Darwin had had, his book had had in 20 years, 20, 25 years, is all that that book had been out when he says this manifesto is going to have the same impact on history, the study of history, as his has on biology. It's going to revolutionize everything and everything. So let me just summarize down at the bottom because of my time. If you talk about nature being the ultimate impersonal force, take care of nature. What is our mission? It's to take care of nature, take care of the things in this world that we see. Am I against ecology? No, I'm not at all. I don't believe that's my ultimate mission in life, though. And I think there's a difference. Does that make sense? But this view would believe that. History, if someone takes history as being the ultimate determining force in the world, you need to get on its good side. You need to figure out where in our country the wheel of history is at right now, and you need to get on the upside of it so that you can live your life riding that wheel and going through it in a positive way rather than getting on this side and getting rolled over by the wheel. So you get on the right side of the wheel and you ride that wheel of history because it's going to determine things in the future. If the environment is something that you look at and say that is ultimate, that's the ultimate force in the world today. Therefore, the thing that you need to do is just make life more enjoyable around you. You need to have a good environment at home. You need to be happy. I don't think my dad at this point, since he's been gone a number of years, would mind me sharing this. I think where he's at now, he would want me to share this. But I remember when my dad left my mom after 38 years of marriage. And and everything, I couldn't get a hold of him. I didn't know he had gotten married. He got married 1 week after the divorce was final to a lady he had been having a liaison with for a number of years, I found out later. And I was just befuddled. And I asked my dad, "Dad, what do you want me to tell your grandchildren?" And I'll never forget his words. He says, "Well, just tell them at least now I'm happy." And I said, "Really? That's what life has boiled down to for you? At least now you're happy?" And if the environment is determinative, then I just need to change my environment to where I'm happy. If I don't like this person I'm married to, get rid of them. Be happy. As Epicurus said, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Just make yourself happy. That's all that's important. Just feel good. Do good to yourself. And that's what becomes the most important thing in life. Okay. Sorry for that somber moment. Let's move on. A personal atheistic substitute. 4 points under that real quick. Number one, there is no creator God to look at or to count on, or if he's there, we don't know it, we can't know it, and therefore it doesn't make any difference. Number two, a person is a product which has risen to the top of the evolutionary mountain by the achieved superiority of previous beings before him. That's part of what Darwin was talking about in The Descent of Man. By the way, who would be the ultimate person in this view? The only difference between this view and the last one is it's a personal atheistic view. There is a person that is ultimate, and it's either me or we as mankind, but it's personal, and we're ultimate or I'm ultimate. But this is a person, or mankind is a product which has given rise to risen to the top of the evolutionary mountain. In The Descent of Man, what Darwin is doing in that long last major volume that he wrote, he is saying, let's not forget the implications of evolution on who we are. We're up here in terms of having risen there. What did you do to get us there? Nothing. So what have you got to be proud about? What have you got to boast about? You did nothing to get us there. In fact, it was all by chance. So lest we get too cocky that we're king of the mountain, let's remember we didn't become king of the mountain by climbing the mountain. We were placed there by our forefathers and by apes and monkeys and da-da-da on down the line. We just happened to be there. Don't get too cocky about who you are. Remember, you're nothing more than just something that slithered out of the primordial ooze. That's all that you are. Interesting. So we're just a product that has risen to the top of the evolutionary mountain. Therefore, number three, a person or mankind must accept his superior role in this world by pursuing to be God himself in this life. You need to take responsibility for your life. And don't look to anyone else or anything else to make life work for you. You need to do it yourself. You need to take control of your life and make it work. Now, Darwin has had, I started off by talking about Darwin, but he has had a phenomenal impact on everyone. I would be willing to say that most of us in this room, when we think about people who lived 10,000 years ago, we think of them as primitive. Right? We think of cavemen. We think of primitive human beings. That's why when we see the pyramids, there are many people in our world today that think, there's no explanation for how cavemen could have built the pyramids, except maybe there were extraterrestrial people that came here and built those, or gave them the blueprints for those, or showed them how to do it, or something. I mean, really? Really? Adam named the animals based upon biological distinctions, skeletal structure and skin type. He was a scientist. He was brilliant. He wasn't a caveman, but we've been impacted to think about people before us were primitive. Didn't really know that much, couldn't really figure things out. We often are impacted by that. The thing that strikes me today is, as I look at our world, is third point. Accept responsibility. Pursue being God yourself, being in charge of your own life, taking responsibility for your own life. You are what's ultimate. Don't look to anyone or anything else. And what it leads to is that this world, especially the Western world, is filled with control freaks. Many of us in this room included are control freaks, aren't we? Where does that come from? Where does that come from? One person's pointing to their partner. Where does that come from? Are you really in control? Am I really in control? ultimately? See, we don't become control freaks by being thoroughly convinced to the essence of our core of our being that he is in control. Because if he's in control, then I'm not. And yet we get so tied up in a knot of, I've got to be in control, I've got to take care of things, I've got to make sure everything. Now, I'm not talking about being irresponsible, but you need to... I did a whole study one time on the opposite of faith is not doubt, it's control. And when we try to control things, it's an act of unfaithfulness. We're not trusting him, the one who is in control. We're trying to take that job from him and do it ourselves. Okay, mankind's or a person's goal is twofold in this view. Number one, to enjoy his achieved superiority personally, so enjoy it. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And everything. The problem with that is it's empty. And it doesn't really, it's not very fulfilling. It's just empty. It doesn't work in terms of being a compelling mission. How many times have you heard in business journals or things on leadership that people need something bigger than themselves to believe in? Written by people who don't even believe in God. They would probably put themselves, many of those writers and speakers would probably put themselves in this category that we're talking about right now, but they would say, we need to live for something bigger than ourselves. Why? Because what I believe doesn't work. It's not fulfilling to eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. Because you eat, drink, and be merry, you're going to die sooner. Okay? And that's all you got to look forward to. So what's so fulfilling about that? Not much. So it leads to sort of a backhanded second mission. Part of the mission for this viewpoint is to make sure that this world continues to afford mankind his superior opportunity and place in the evolution of the future. But if I am a humanist, I believe I, as a human being, am ultimate and I am accountable to no one and responsible to no one whatsoever, it makes no sense to me whatsoever that I need to make sure this world is a better place to live in. I just need to make sure that my world is as good as I can make it. That's all I need to do. I can't make this whole world a better place, but I can make my corner of it, my piece of the pie, I can make it as good as possible. I can do that. This view would say naturally. If I'm ultimate, then I am accountable to no one or nothing. I'm accountable to no government. Personally, what this view leads to is isolation as an individual. I just take care of myself. Socially, what it leads to, ultimately, logically, is anarchy. Every man doing or every person doing what's right in their own eyes. That's what it leads to. I can become king of the hill. If I get rid of everything that makes my life difficult, if I believe this view, then ultimately I whittle it down to where I'm the last man standing. And that's fulfilling. Okay, now I'm here. Nobody to bother me. Nobody to cause me problems. Nobody I have to share with. Anything with. It's all mine. Now what do? How empty is that? And so it leads to this secondhand, backhanded thing of, well, we need to make this a better world to live in. Even though it's illogical, that's what we need to do. We need to feed what got us to the top of the hill and keep us there. It doesn't make any sense logically, but that's what we hear. Look at the last paragraph down there. By Jean-Paul Sartre, one of your favorite authors at this point, I'm sure. I just want to read a couple sentences. Look at the first sentence. The best way to conceive of the fundamental project of human reality is to say that man is the being whose project, whose goal, whose mission is to be what? God. Look down at the third to the last line. To be man means to reach toward being God, or if you prefer, man fundamentally is the desire to be God. That's our mission. And the thing that I appreciate about Jean-Paul Sartre is that he was thoroughly consistent. He said it like it really is. You're God. He was a pure humanist in the sense that you are God and there is nothing else or no one else that you are accountable to or responsible to other than you. And you have to take care of yourself. And when you don't like life anymore, just end it, which is what he did. When life got unbearable for him later in life, he was consistent. He committed suicide because he's the only one to make life better for him, and that was going to make it better somehow. Now, he's totally illogical, but at least he was consistent, okay? And that's what he's saying it's all about. That's our mission if we believe in a personal theistic substitute for God. It's just to make ourselves God. Or if mankind, if I am a person who believes in humanity is ultimate and that sort of thing, then we would say we need to take care of humanity. And in that sense, that would be true. Okay, now then. On the last page of your notes, to wrap it up, and we don't need to spend a lot of time here. Number one leads to number two. Number two leads to number three. Number one, the further one gets from believing there is a personal God who created mankind for his own purposes, the more mankind becomes the very purpose of his own existence. And that leads to number two. Without a creator God, man is left to be self-serving and self-fulfilling. Man determines by himself what his mission is, how to achieve it for his own benefit, and to measure his own success by his own standard of measure. All kinds of circular self-defeating reasoning going on there, but that leads to number three. Selfishness is an empty and self-defeating mission in life. As I mentioned before, individuality leads to narcissism. Socially, it leads to anarchy, and relationally, it leads to isolationism, being alone. Number four, the supposed mission of making the world a better place is empty and vain if it is to be achieved by selfish, self-serving, individualistic gods. These views of mission. Whenever you take God out of the equation, the God of the Bible, I need to be clear in this class, whenever we take God of the Bible in his fullest sense out of the equation, it seems to always come back to me being what's ultimate. We've looked at these five views, but they very naturally move toward the right, to where that last view, it talks about very honestly, well, it's all about me. And we cannot live in a world, this world today, and be halfway alert at what's going on without realizing that's the message that the world is teaching us, our children, over and over again. It's all about you. It's all about me. Take care of yourself, because if you don't, nobody else will. You deserve a break today. It's all about you. It's all about me. It's about me as an individual. And that will naturally lead to relativism. Why does that lead to relativism? Everything's relative. There is no absolute truth. There cannot be an absolute truth, any absolute truth, if every one of us is an individual God and determines what's true for ourselves. That's what relativism is. You believe what you believe, and that's okay for you, but I believe what I believe, and that's okay for me. Because why? Because I'm the one that determines what's true, because I'm what's ultimate in this life. And it leaves the God of this book out of the equation altogether. And we start living differently. Next week, we want to look at mission. What does the Bible say about why are we here? And again, I think we're going to get into some things that you maybe haven't thought about before. Let me pray. Father, thank you so much that we don't have to just listen to the voices of this world to answer these significant questions of life. Where do we come from and why are we here? Thank you that you have given us your word. I pray that you would help us this week as we study the passages in the next section that are laid out there, that you would help us to understand more clearly why we're here from your vantage point. Hear your word on this. You've given us a sure word that we can count on. Help us to hear, help us to understand what you want to say. In Jesus' name, amen. Got some discussion questions, and we'll see you next week.